Hey, you got the morning show. We're there and now in the studio. I've got Finn Mackesy. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we're here to talk permaculture, as we like to do every Monday, but it's not Monday, but that's Easter. We got you in this morning, which is good. So you wanted to move into a period where we talk about permaculture principles.
Yeah.
What are these principles all about? Why does permaculture need principles? Isn't it just gardening?
Thank you. So I guess a few things to say about that. So from early on, mid-1980s, when Bill started teaching permaculture.
This is Bill Mollison.
One
of the founders.
There were several kind of principles, I guess, that were often talked about. Some of the ones that come to mind is all elements or single element, multiple function. So every element in the system should have multiple uses. And then the flip side of that was, you know, each function should be covered by multiple elements. And so there were there was another one of stacking in time and space. And so the idea is you make use of all these edges, and you so when you're thinking about like gardening or forest gardening, is how do you think through time and making sure that you have yields over, you know, over months and over years, et cetera, et cetera. There were several of these that were kind of principles of sort.
It's part of the sort of like, I've heard about permaculture forest or food forest, where there's like seven layers.
Yeah.
And so it's not just one crop happening
on
the spot, but there's stuff underground, there's stuff on the ground, small bushes, trees.
Yeah. That is climatic specific in terms of the number of layers in a, depending on where you are in the world in terms of the amount of available sunlight and etc.
But I sort of feel like that's
still the same principle.
That's a really good example of what permaculture is about for me as someone kind of on the outside. Is that, you know, you try and make a garden and it's hard work, but then there's this whole system and there's seven layers to it perhaps, and it's all integrated and part of an ecosystem. And it kind of happens.
And I think,
because the idea that I would have seven different crops growing in one spot without the permaculture knowledge is just an impossibility. It's almost like magic. From the point of view of a civilized, non-agricultural human being.
And I think that's a really important point because, you know, over time, land-based peoples realize that, you know, this idea of stacking in time and space are, you know, just makes sense because you can have multiple yields. Like the maybe one of the more famous examples is the milpa, the Mesoamerican garden where you have, you know, the three sisters, corn, squash, and beans all growing together. And the beans go up the corn, the squash goes out and covers the ground, creates weed control, provides habitat for predator insects, et cetera, et cetera. So these three plants all work really well together, and that was just something that developed through time. But getting back to this idea of principles, so they've kind of always been there in permaculture. And in 2003, I believe it was, with David Holmgren, the other co-originator of permaculture, with his with this book, they talk about he introduces 12 principles. And the 12 principles come from, I guess, he teases out this idea of what are principles and why are they important more specifically than I think anything that I've read from Bill.
Yeah.
And for him, they are kind of shorthands or a type of a tool that you might use, a thinking tool, because what you talked about is, well, one of the things you were alluding to is, you know, complexity. And we spent the last two chats talking about systems. And so in complex systems, there's so many things to think about. And our brains aren't really particularly wired for being able to understand and interact with and manage complexity in that way. And so principles become these slogans or checklists of ways to, you know, almost mnemonics, shorthands for thinking about, oh, what are the things I need to consider when thinking about systems ecology and how nature works and how do I design with nature. So they're exactly that. So there's a series of 12 of them that that David's developed, and they're broken up, and we can get into a bit of the details, but there's essentially the first six and the second six. that he talks about. And that's what I want to introduce and talk about today. And what I'm hoping to do through this process is, as your kind of cheeky comment alluded to before, is, you know, this isn't about gardening.
Yeah.
This is about designing with complexity and making informed choices in our day-to-day lives. And so my challenge to myself is to try to make the principles as relevant and meaningful for listeners as possible. And that's whether you've got, you know, almost irrespective of what your day-to-day might look like, is how can you use these principles to think about a range of different choices or challenges you might have.
Okay, so let's take it out from where I jokingly said gardening. So you can design a garden with permaculture principles.
Absolutely.
You can design a homestead and the home.
Yep.
So house designers.
And I would say neighborhoods.
Yeah, well, that's where I was going. House designers, urban planners, governments for whole country growth.
Yeah.
Could be using permaculture principles.
Absolutely.
So this is I'm just talking about a built environment,
yep.
but you then are talking about other aspects of life.
Yeah, well, the social domain, you know, is how people, you know, like I think we could use permaculture principles to think about decision making, you know, and governance and a whole range of things. And there is some challenges here because this is looking at how natural systems work and the way in which organisms and systems kind of tend to self-organize.
Yeah.
And at risk of overstating the point is, industrial consumer culture is not organized along, not really along systems ecology or natural processes in terms of, you know, there's a scale and means that are a little bit of a detour for everything else that nature has created so far.
Okay.
And so there's some limits to, you know, it's not like we could use permaculture principles to make industrial consumer society utopian.
A better industrial consumer society.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
the system would need to fundamentally reorganize.
Yeah, I mean, because industrial consumer society is a problem.
Yeah, well,
it's like if your house is burning down, you don't use permaculture to make a better fire.
No, you put the fire out.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah,
how to use permaculture to rebuild.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Might be where we are with our society at the moment. We need to put the fire out rather than try and make it better at what it does.
Yeah, but I do think there are ways in which, again, like all systems, they evolve and change. And by thinking differently, the system starts to change. But again, the scale of what we're talking about is so significant that we're more talking about, you know, Raglan scale than we are talking about New Zealand scale.
This, you know, there's a lot of discussions being had at the moment on this show with in the political realm. We've got one big urban development happening in Rangatahi. There's another one about to come on across the other side of Te Huruwai Road, another 400 houses there. And part of the discussion is it's turning out that the developers are the ones deciding where a Raglan bypass road might go, and the community hasn't yet had any input. And that's a failure on the behalf of the council, I think, to not have that done sooner. But we could be using permaculture principles to actually do that urban infrastructure plan as well, couldn't we?
I believe so. And it's really interesting.
In fact, would we call it part of a catchment plan?
Well, it should be part of a catchment plan because you need to manage your water almost first and foremost. And so if we're thinking about catchments as...
Don't roads come first, though? Roads are more important than water.
No.
You should see the look.
No, ecology first. Ecology first.
I got the patient teacher look there. Yeah, I'll just have to explain this again.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I say that to make a point.
And I do get that, and I appreciate, because we do live in a world that is all about efficiency and expediency.
Yeah.
But you can't build a sustainable culture on a non-sustainable landscape, right? So if we compromise our water systems... we are compromising our future sustainability. And I know you know that, but I think it is worth restating that. So again, these principles are shorthands, I guess, for being able to think really dynamically and really critically about complexity. Because I understand why people think about roads first. Is, you know, they're major investments, they cost heaps of money. And if it's all about efficiency, how do you get people from A to B as with as little friction as possible, then so I understand. But again, I would say that's simplistic thinking, right? That's not thinking about the whole system. And so that's why. So this is a really good example about why principles are really useful. And so they were designed to be relatively universal in terms of looking across the natural world and pre-industrial sustainable cultures. How do systems self-organize? So what else to say about that? So I guess these principles have come from what I would consider, I guess, ecology, but more specifically, systems ecology is the major discipline, I guess, that's contributed. But then there's also things like ethnobotany, so humans' relationship to plants, in particular, most commonly how indigenous and traditional societies have learn to work with and use plants, and then also landscape geography are these two other disciplines that David has kind of integrated into the development of these principles. And there's nothing, they are intuitive and they're designed to be relatively accessible and easy to understand. So it's about taking what's otherwise some not necessarily complex or complicated ideas, but taking stuff that is in some ways really sophisticated and stating it in really simple terms. And I guess what's worth saying is, you know, we have lots and lots of whakatauki, whether they're whakatauki Maori or from other cultures and traditions. But, you know, proverbs, sayings that are full of these of this kind of rich wisdom that's been passed down from generation to generation often contain a lot of these principles in them. And so, you know, what David has done isn't necessarily taken something from... he hasn't necessarily created anything new. He's just pooled, I guess, all this collective resource and wisdom based on his own observations as well, and distilled it down into something that, at least for me in my life, has been really, really useful.
I remember when the book came out. Could you say 2003?
Yeah, that sounds right. It maybe 2002, but I think it was 2003.
There was a kind of a buzz in the permaculture world and the surrounding world about this. It's like, I'm nearly making a joke about receiving a new biblical text. But it's not really appropriate, because David would hate that.
He absolutely would. But there is something in what you're saying, I guess, in that there was something foundational or... kind of a wind of change. There was a much deeper, to my mind anyway, grounding. He laid a new foundation for permaculture and, I guess, kind of allied systems ecology frameworks and disciplines.
Was it new insights, or was it the same insights in a way that people could access them better?
Well, there's two bits to that, and I don't think David would necessarily mind saying this, but his writing isn't always super accessible. It's so dense.
Yeah.
But the way in which he's distilled it down, I think, did pull a whole bunch of ideas together. He doesn't, and he never has claimed to, I guess, been, the inventor of new knowledge necessarily. But at the same time, I think what he did do was really articulate the value of principles and frame them around this idea of sustainable culture and the conscious patterning of, or, you know, using design and using regenerative design to create sustainable culture. And so
you wouldn't, so my understanding is that there wasn't, the point of permaculture was not to bring new information. The information was out there. It was to put it in a way that was useful for someone to design a sustainable system.
There is a lot of that, and Permaculture One is very much compiling things together. What is interesting, though, is, and this is a little bit of a detour, but from what I understand, is David's thesis was really about trying to pull three threads together that have never been pulled together before,
yes,
not in any systematic way. And I'd say, you know, that's probably in some ways outside of indigenous cultures. But again, I think there was a different framing and orientation around how they developed a lot of their regenerative design skills and kind of practices. So he was trying to bring agriculture, land use and ecology together.
Yeah. And we have such a tradition in our culture, a scientific tradition of separating all
well,
the disciplines.
Well, and maybe that's it, is indigenous cultures never separated it, so there wasn't that challenge to be had, whereas because these ecology was distinct from land use, which was distinct from food production or agriculture, then, he was exploring, trying to weave them back together again.
And it's almost like the permaculture principle, or not principle, a permaculture concept of edges being where all sorts of interesting things happen. It is a principle, okay. Yeah, I suddenly realized I didn't know. But that thing about edges being the fertile area where all the interesting stuff's happening.
Use edges and value the marginal.
Yeah, and so combining these three disciplines and the edges where they meet was such a fertile place to create this whole new way of looking at the world. And now science is doing that too. My daughter's studying science at university, and she was like, look at this long word, and it was immuno-neurobiology or something. It was a word like that, where they've realized that they can't talk about your mental health without talking about your gut and your neurobiology as well, right? You can't just keep studying them separately.
You have to weave them together.
You have to weave them together to get a whole
being. Integrate rather than segregate. Another permaculture.
Oh, there
principle.
We go. All right.
So again, this is what I find interesting about it is, and I'm not saying, not that permaculture is better or further ahead or anything like that, but it is interesting how the permaculture principles are, or modern science is catching up with nature-based observation is maybe a better way of saying it is, indigenous peoples have known things that science has still not been able to crack, and some of the cutting edges of science are now starting to go, oh, that's what indigenous cultures have been talking about for millennium, is now there's this more sophisticated or nuanced way that science is able to move past reductionism to actually starting to look at holes again.
Yeah. I mean, I think there were huge benefits to reductionism in the sense that there was so much to be learned by going that way, and so much has been learned, but then you've got to...
But it has inherent limits, right?
Yeah, and you've got to come back up into the world where everyone's operating and apply
put things back together again and see if it still makes sense when you actually look at things as complete systems.
And I've got to be able to explain it too. My daughter wanted me to help her with her science last night, and I was reading these papers, and I was like, oh, I just need to translate everything. Why can't they speak in normal English? But of course, they're never going to. And there's a discussion to be had about that. There's a lot of ego in that, having a specialist language. I feel like permaculture has tried to avoid that.
Yeah.
To a degree, having that inaccessible specialist language.
Yeah, but I'm torn by that too, because I think we need words to communicate ideas, right?
Yeah.
And that's an obvious thing to say, but language does inform our cognition, our worldview. And if we lack certain words to communicate certain ideas, then we're impoverished from a thinking point of view. And I know that just from speaking other languages, is other languages have different ways of seeing and understanding the world, and I can't access those through English.
Right.
And so sometimes we do need words, and how do we make them accessible? How do we make them...
How do you translate them back? Because what I was reading last night was needed translating.
Yeah, and I do understand that, and so maybe that's the extreme of it. But there is something to be said, I think, for the creation of new words. To fill gaps as we start to understand the world in new ways. Autopoiesis, I think, is a beautiful word, and again, needs translating. But the English language lacks that, this idea of living organisms are kind of... They self-organize in... they're self-organizing and self-generating.
So you need a sentence to explain a word.
Yeah. So how do we create, is self-generation enough? But words that start to suggest or bring life back to life.
And I think the job of the expert is actually not to stay in that world with that specialist language, but to use it and then be able to translate it, because they're the only ones that can translate it back. And I feel like with the principles that David Holmgren has put together in the book, that's kind of what he's trying to do.
That's exactly what he's trying to do. And so what might be useful is if I run through them, the principles now. And so again, the first six are mostly about considering systems from a bottom-up perspective. So thinking about you know, design principles from an elements and organism or individuals point of view. So how would kind of the units within a larger system think and operate, if that kind of makes sense. So the first one is observe and interact. And I think this requires a deeper dive because it's really, it is quite dense. But at face value, I think it's, again, fairly intuitive, is as living beings, we observe and we interact in the systems we live in. Yep. And looping back just briefly to, we talked about David Snowden's Kunefin framework when we were talking about systems. And he talks about what you do in complex systems is you need to sense, probe, act. And so, you know, you might say, being a little bit jargony, is you might say instead of observe and interact, you might say interact and observe. But again, that's a detail that we can pick up later in terms of you need to, in complex systems, you need to act into the system to see what happens.
Yes.
But yep. Either way is this idea of we're not objective elements, we are subjects in a living system. We are actors in the system. And so how do we use our senses and all of our senses to meaningfully act? And then we've got catch and store energy, which hopefully is, again, fairly self-explanatory. We have obtain a yield. Apply self-regulation and accept feedback. And I would say this is one of the things where if there was one principle that industrial consumer society could maybe gain the most immediate value from, it might be this principle here: apply self-regulation and accept feedback. And there's use and value renewable resources and services.
Say that one again.
Use and value renewable resources and services.
Okay, yep.
And so again, there is, some of these are a little bit dense and they don't necessarily flow off the tongue, but he is really trying to keep them as accessible and simple in language as possible.
But that's something extreme Zero Waste would say.
Yeah.
That would be a large part of their message.
And the next one would definitely be part of their message as well. Yeah. Produce no waste, number six.
Yeah, that's a real challenge for our culture.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And then the second set six are really emphasizing the patterns and relationships that emerge through systems, self-organizational co-evolution. So how do systems kind of function as a system, which is made up of lots of individuals and organisms within that? And so now we're starting to think about how do systems seem to co-evolve? How do systems make decisions about to kind of navigate? You know, because again, you can imagine the system as a whole, there's a whole bunch of individuals that are constantly making choices. And then the system that all those organisms are in are also creating order and structure. Yep, and adapting to changes and all the rest of it. So these principles are, number seven, design from patterns to detail.
Okay.
So again, the spider web is probably a good example of that. But, you know, the systems never really organize from the top down. They always organize from the bottom up. So what's the pattern? And then the details emerge out of the pattern. Number eight, integrate rather than segregate. Number nine, use slow and small solutions. 10, use and value diversity. 11, use edges and value the marginal. And number 12, creatively use and respond to change.
Okay.
And so a few things that might be useful to say about this. The principles further is... you know, David's really explicit that these principles should never be used as a substitute for relevant real-world experience. So, you know, they don't replace years and years of, I don't know, experience in a garden or in whatever area of expertise or, you know, technical knowledge people have. Is these support that. They don't replace it.
Interesting, because we love our ideologies and our principles.
Hmm.
We love that. Not cling to them, but rely on them. We love to lean on them. And
yep. Yeah. And I guess in the absence of necessarily that kind of technical knowledge or that kind of deep, relevant, experiential practice or knowledge, is having principles as somewhere to start is actually really useful. But if we already have those as a starting point, these just become, again, adjuncts or in support of, in service to. So all of the principles have an icon or a symbol associated with them.
Yeah.
And then they have an English whakatauki, a saying, an expression that kind of captures some of the wisdom that's embedded in trying to communicate some of the essence of that principle.
I actually really, I like the structure that David's done. He's come up with the dense, he's done all the dense work to really, and fleshed everything out really thoroughly. And then he's able to come back up and say, here's the principle, here's a saying that explains it briefly.
Yep.
And then we can go into the detail. So you can access it from any level.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing he says that I think is really true for me as well is that he thinks that all of the kind of the nuance and the quite sophisticated deep wisdom that's in the principles is probably better understood and communicated through a lot of indigenous and traditional myths and stories.
Yeah.
And so he's recognizing that, well, there's a whole bunch of kind of scientific thinking and whatnot that informs these. Actually, we can turn to a lot of our, I don't know, children's nursery rhymes or folk tales from a whole range of cultures, and which also espouse or communicate elements or similar or parallel concepts to what are embedded in these principles. And so, you know, you can think of, I can think of any number of ones, but like the story of stone soup, for example, comes to mind. Of, I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, a beautiful story about a traveler who wanders into a village who is afflicted with, if nothing else, a mindset of scarcity and poverty.
Yeah.
And so he gets a big cauldron and puts it in the middle of town and says, oh, I'm going to make myself a delicious stone soup. And coaxes the villagers into sharing some of their surplus. And collectively they brew this beautiful soup that then they start sharing again as a community. And it took this outsider to come in and to kind of remind them that actually they all have enough to share. And even while they might think things are scarce or difficult, and so that one folktale communicates a lot of the principles kind of in one. And that was, I guess, another thing that David is clear on too, is any examples or stories that we might use to try to flesh out these principles, which I think we should as we go through them one by one, is that they'll almost always talk to some of the other principles as well. And so they're kind of interconnected.
Yeah, this is, I'm completely running out of time, but this reminds me again of what was happening last night for me, getting into some dense science without, and I think what you're talking about, what that's providing is a framework, a mental map for the details to plug into.
That's
whereas
exactly
the way
right.
The way they seem to be teaching science is they're just throwing details at you and throwing them and throwing them and throwing them until eventually you've got enough that you can build your own mental map. But the process of getting there is just basically having to memorize detail.
Yep.
It's a very hard way to learn.
So design from pattern to detail. So that's exactly what David's doing.
Is
he's kind of showing the patterns by which nature seems to self-organize.
Yeah.
And then we can flesh that out with the detail. And that's one of the things, I know we're running out of time, but just a comment for me. One of the things I really love about permaculture is, and this is definitely using more of a kind of an industrial metaphor, but it's provided me like almost like a filing system, a way of storing a whole bunch of information in a framework, in a pattern that makes a lot of sense to me. And so when I get new information or new ideas, I go, oh, that aligns with this concept or this principle. And so I have a way of making sense of the world around me. And, you know, and you could say the downside of that is it just reinforces previous conceptions. But when something doesn't fit, I don't necessarily try to force it or jam it in.
Well, you've got a choice then of whether you redesign your filing cabinet, your mental map, or whether you jam it in.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have that choice every day sometimes when we're confronted with new stuff. Hmm. Yeah. Hey, folks, we've been talking to Finn Mackesy, our permaculture man. And thank you for coming in on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
And so next time we'll get stuck into those principles and see
one by one, I think we'll just kinda,
how deep they take us.
Yeah,
excellent. I have a feeling some of them will be complex. Yeah. All right, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we have reached the end of the show for the day. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back again tomorrow morning.